From Santa Barbara, California, Timeless Voyager Radio with Bruce Stephen Holmes. Self-development radio for the open mind. Interviews with leading-edge authors and speakers in the fields of environmental issues, alternative healthcare, new psychology, psychic phenomena, UFOs, and extraterrestrial encounters. And now, Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes for Timeless Voyager Radio. And I'd like to welcome all of you listeners out there across the United States and the rest of the world, and certainly in different parts of California, to the show. I think that you're really going to enjoy today's show because I have a very, very interesting guest, author, speaker, and teacher, Nancy Cook de Herrera. She has written a very interesting book called Beyond Gurus, and we're going to learn a lot about gurus and how they are sold and marketed and so on and so forth. Welcome to the show, Nancy.
Thank you, Bruce.
Why the title?
Well, I'll tell you, there's quite a misunderstanding about gurus in the Western world. Most of the Eastern teachers who come here, let's say to the United States, they come to teach the householder's way, not the monk's way.
Let's define a householder,
okay,
and a monk.
Monk goes, he retreats from the world, sort of goes into a cave and retreats to get everything
so
for himself.
Reclusive.
A reclusive, he renounces everything. The householder's path is what we're living. We're living out in the world. They have an old saying in India, you go into the bank not to sit there and look at the money, but to take the money out into the marketplace and spend it. And this is what the Eastern gurus or teachers who are coming to the United States are mainly teaching. So you're invited to take the knowledge from them and then go out in the world and use the tools they've given you to become a creative radio personality, a mother, a doctor, a lawyer. Nothing to do with this cult mentality.
Now, so basically what you're saying, if I've got this straight now, is that there are two different pathways, let's say, to,
yes,
quote unquote, this idea of enlightenment that,
just
that people
as fast,
are looking for.
Each one too.
And the Western world, which we live in, this capitalistic society, is what, 99%, I hate to use percentages, but the majority of the people are householders.
Absolutely.
Namely that they live in activity.
Right, absolutely.
And
raise families,
okay,
and
then these techniques or these teachers that are teaching are teaching for the householder.
Yes, and so you must get the knowledge and then leave your teacher and go out into the world and use the knowledge they have given you. So you could never develop into a cult mentality like we've seen in this Waco mess.
Now, what exactly do you mean by the word cult?
Well, I think that when you give everything over to a teacher, in my mind, no man is such a master of himself that he should be a master of anyone else. But when you go and sit at his feet and give all your worldly goods to him and expect him as a father figure to solve all your problems, and you become just like a sheep, that is the cult mentality.
Okay, so basically what we're learning very quickly here is that you're saying that most of these teachers do not want what a devotee is. That what you're
saying? Like Maharishi, for instance, he said when he first came here, "I have not come here to teach a generation of meditators. I have come to teach doctors, lawyers, mothers, students to meditate."
Mm-hmm. And you're referring to Maharishi Mahesh Yogi.
Yes, yes. I speak a great deal about Maharishi because in 1962. I took his course and I believe very much in his technique of transcendental meditation.
Okay. So this is a big book, isn't it?
It has 170 pictures in it. That's what makes it so big.
Okay. And it has a lot of pages too. I don't 480 plus pages. That's a big book. Now this, again, we were talking about the title. So Beyond Gurus means what?
Get the knowledge from the guru and then leave him and go out and have a creative life using the knowledge that he has given you.
So the point that you've made then is a very important point.
Go beyond the guru.
Right. The guru is supposed to be the catalyst, and then that's it. You're not supposed to spend your entire life with the guru?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Hmm.
As I said, you go to the bank to get the money to bring it out and use it in the marketplace, not to sit in the bank and look at it.
Now, of course, we see, though, that people generally take a guru and then they stick with him, call him their master or guru.
But that is a very big misunderstanding. It's like, so often I'm asked, people will say, as I'm a teacher of transcendental meditation, oh, I could never do that. I can't concentrate. And I'll say, wait a minute. You know, there's a difference between concentration, contemplation, and meditation. The first two are the fixing of the mind. Meditation is the freeing of the mind.
So those people that say that they're meditating with a concentrative technique are what?
Well, I feel that maybe they should switch teachers.
All right. Let me see. You must have started somewhere on this quest for some type of spiritual growth.
I went out really looking for a crutch. My husband died many years ago when our daughter was just 9 months old. And it was really kind of a tragedy, Bruce, because we had been on a vacation and we had visited Zion Canyon National Park. And we came driving out on a beautiful day. As a matter of fact, I was driving. And we were stopped by these three army corporals asking us, what were you doing on this road? The road was closed. And they said, didn't you know there had been an atomic fallout? And of course, we knew nothing. There was no radio reception in Zion Canyon. And so one soldier asked me if he could put the Geiger counter on my moccasin to see if I were radioactive. And when the...
This is a great, great thing for somebody to say, right?
Right.
They want to see if you're radioactive.
Yes,
what a great...
You know, we didn't know anything about it then.
Right.
And this is, 1953.
When people routinely were exposed to fallout, weren't they?
Well, they didn't know it, but they were.
Saying,
the facts are really coming out now.
Yeah.
Anyway, when the Geiger counter went all the way up to the top, I remember asking the man, what does that mean? And he said, it means you're hot, lady. And I said, oh, thank you very much. Thinking it was sort of amusing until my husband said, Nancy, I don't think this is a laughing matter. And unfortunately, we were both found to be radioactive. Our car was the hottest one in the day, that day, they said. And after sending us to a decontamination center, they told us to check in with a doctor in 6 months and sort of let it go at that. And 18 months later, my husband died of acute leukemia, exactly the same kind that those who survived the first blast in Hiroshima died of 18 to 20 months later.
Now, how is it that you
How come I happened to survive?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's because he was 14 years older. He'd had hepatitis just before we had left on our trip.
So he had a weaker immune system or something?
Absolutely. And I'd had once, years ago, they gave me the wrong blood transfusion. And a cardiologist friend of mine said that is probably what saved my life, because in order to survive the wrong transfusion, my body put up such a battle that I undoubtedly, created a lot of antibodies.
Huh. So basically what happened then, this atomic fallout caused the leukemia in your husband, and
yes,
he died. And so then you decided to take a trip to India?
No, it was such an overwhelming experience for me. And the books that well-meaning friends gave me to read didn't help. And so, let's say 7 years passed before I got to India, and I had an essential need to believe that there is justice in the universe. And so by the time I got to India, I had arrived at the conclusion that had to involve many lifetimes in order to have real justice. And in the meantime, I had become a goodwill personality with the State Department. I was supposedly the typical American housewife, and I was in Iran doing a fundraising show for these women who were taking the chador off of the Iranian women. And a friend of mine who owned a mind science foundation in Texas, his name was Tom Slick, he was quite well known in those fields, he asked me if I'd like to join him and this other parapsychologist for a month in the Himalayas. They were going to call on lamas, swamis, and yogis, looking for psychic and physical phenomena that could be repeated scientifically under conditions back at the Mind Science Foundation in San Antonio.
So it's kind of like a fact-finding tour.
Yes, and I knew right away that, you know, I'd have so much wonderful lecturing material. So the book starts out at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm praying that Tom and his friend will be there to meet me, because I'd never been in India before. And I had a very strong premonition that this trip was going to be very important and would change my life, and indeed it did. While the men were off looking for their psychic phenomena, I started to ask questions, and only because I was traveling with these two well-known parapsychologists did I have the honor of sitting at the feet of some of the great spiritual teachers of India. In fact, I was so naive in my spiritual questions, I asked Lama Anagrika Govinda if he believed in reincarnation. Tom said to me afterwards, "You know, Nancy, that's kind of like asking him if he breathes." I'd start somewhere.
Well, the point here, though, is that if you don't ask questions, you will never find out the answers.
That's right.
So one should not ever be ashamed of whatever question one asks.
No, know? And one thing I found out was that most of these holy men, when they got their first money, the first thing they bought was a printing press, and the first thing they printed was a list of things to give up. And I was not in the mood to give up anything except their literature, so I would go on to the next holy man. And it wasn't until I got to the Valley of the Saints, and I met a very famous Swami named Shivananda. And I just said, "Your Holiness, I'm very happy with my Western way of living. I do not want to withdraw from life, but I would like to have more spiritual knowledge." And he's the one who said, "There is a man who has an ashram across the river from here. His name is Mahesh, and he teaches a way for the householder." It's the first time I'd heard that. And he said, "I think he would be the teacher for you, Nancy." So I took a boat, went across the Ganges, climbed up the hill to find that Maharishi Mahesh Yogi had just left for California.
So you left you left California.
That's right.
To go to India to find out that the man that you should see had just left India to go to California.
Right. I always tell people, you don't have to go to India to find it. It's within you in the first place.
While you were in India, though, you were privy to some interesting miraculous feats or presentations. Maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about those.
Well, I think one of the most outstanding ones was we looked for this yogi who was sitting on top of a temple in Hardwar, which is just 13 miles below Rishikesh in the Valley of the Saints. It's probably the second most holy place in India. And he was sitting in the sun. It was a hot day. He had almost no clothes on, so he couldn't hide any props. And through an interpreter, he finally agreed to talk to us about man's obligation to the universe and to the earth, because on a whole, most of these holy people are not very happy with scientists who don't understand the destructive side of scientific discoveries also. And he took a glass of water, and we put our finger in the water. We were not hypnotized. And then he just held the glass, concentrated on it, and turned it into ice. And of course, I knew that I'd seen something that was impossible, but there it was. And it was still, you know, H2O, two molecules of hydrogen and one of oxygen. And he explained to us that a yogi's ability to master some of the laws of nature is what gives him the right to call himself a yogi.
So when a person refers to themselves as a yogi, it's because they have mastered the cities,
The cities, yes. And I know in India, for instance, they revere Jesus as a great yogi, a great prophet and yogi.
Now, I always thought to attain the title yogi, though, that you had to then give up the presentation part.
Well,
that's what I had heard.
I love that. I think so. Yes, on a whole, yes.
Of course, everybody says, "Oh, that's great." So now, if somebody complains, can say that they do something, then they don't have to show it to you because they've renounced.
Which
it.
Comes first, the chicken or the egg? That's right.
So the person is supposedly able to levitate, but now can't do it in front of you because they have renounced.
That's right. They can't capitalize on it. They can't commercialize it.
All right. But that, of course, is enough to change your
Certainly got my attention.
Right, right. Which is what the purpose of those is, I guess, those
yes.
types of things.
And you know, when people say, but Sai Baba, I mean, all these tricks that he does, and I've been there, I've visited Sai Baba several times, and I'm going to go and see him again in February. And I often remind them, you know, Jesus did some pretty good tricks too.
So what do you think is the purpose of these?
Maybe to help you believe.
So it kind of gets your attention and then...
It sure got my attention. Yes.
Now, of course, the scientists.
Now, when I was at Stanford,
spend all their time measuring and.
Yeah, but you see, this is what attracted me to Maharishi, because when I was at Stanford, I majored in chemistry and bacteriology, and not that I remember very much about it now, but I love the fact that Maharishi, when I finally did find him back in California, he explained things in scientific terms, and I think between you and me, that's the reason why he succeeded in the West. Because he made sure that people could understand what he was saying.
Now, a lot of people don't realize that he was a very successful athlete. And a degree in physics. And then he up and left the world of the established, what shall we call
it? He saw his master to be in a parade going through Allahabad. And he came home and he said to his parents, I know what I want to do with my life now. I want to sit at the feet of Gurudev. And then Gurudev said, go back and finish your education, then come back and you will be more useful to me, which he did. So he has very good credentials.
He, incidentally, for those people who are wondering who Gurudev is,
Sri Brahmanandam Saraswati.
Right.
But you don't have to remember the name. It just means beloved teacher, Gurudev, is a lot easier.
Brahmananda Saraswati.
Yeah.
Of Jyotirmath.
Right.
Which is basically a description of where he's from. And that's in itself an interesting thing, because
yes.
most of these great seers have names that to us are long, but in reality it's basically like saying, Bruce Stephen Holmes of Santa Barbara,
of Goleta,
California.
Or California, right? Exactly.
Who also has Timeless Voyager Radio? I mean, that's basically.
I went to Jyotirmath, and then I also went up to the source of the Ganges. As a matter of fact, the man whose photo is on the cover of the book Tatwala Baba, everybody feels that's quite a provocative cover.
Yeah, let's talk about that cover, because basically, first of all, I've never seen hair that long.
I don't think it was ever cut.
Let's describe this to the listeners, because they can't see it. What you have here is a big full-color picture, and the person who's taking the picture, incidentally, is taking it from the ground, looking up. So you're looking.
It's my son, who is with National Geographic.
So you're looking up from the ground, up the torso of this man who has basically on a
little loincloth.
A little loincloth. And then... looks very powerful. Has hair that is looks like it's in
dreadlocks almost.
That go right to the ground. Okay,
and this they is, mingle with the roots of the tree.
Right, and this man is. Let's talk a little bit about it.
His name was Tatwala Baba, and the first time I met him was during the Kumbh Mela, you know, which happens every 12 years in the Valley of the Saints. And this day, they all came to visit Maharishi. I will never forget it because it was my birthday in 1968. And there were about 12 of these wonderful old sadhus and sannyasins who were there. And then Tatwala Baba walked in. And my first thought when I saw him was, that's the way King Kamehameha should have looked. Because he was a very powerfully built man. And he had a quiet strength that he was a real showstopper. And then I took a picture of him, a Polaroid, and I asked my son, I said, do you think it's all right if I give this to Tatwala Baba? And he said, why not? Everybody else is popping around taking pictures. And when I handed it to him and he looked up at me, he was sitting in the lotus position on the ground by then. I have never seen such light come out of a person's face. So from then on, every year when I would come to visit Maharishi, you know, my book is a summation of 31 trips to India. I would always go to see Tatwala Baba. He lived in a cave, and he...
Now, this is a good point. He definitely is reclusive.
He was totally a recluse. He was between 120 and 124 years old when that picture was taken.
Right, and for those of you who are interested, He looks like a man of about maybe 40.
Yeah, I was going to say 40-ish.
Or maybe even 35.
Only thing that looked old about him were his knees from sitting in the lotus.
Right.
So, and we started to take a picture of him in the... He said, you can take the cave or you can do it under my favorite tree. And when we entered the cave, there was this great big cobra coiled underneath a little bedcloth. So we decided we would use the tree.
This was his pet cobra or something?
He slept with a cobra.
I don't get this part, but...
You know, Bruce, when we came back from the source of the Ganges, we found that somebody had shot and killed Tatwala Baba, the man who's on the cover of the book. Shot him 5 times and killed him. He was a disciple who thought that he was a god, Tatwala Baba, and wanted to prove to the world that his master was indestructible and his aim was good, and he died. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to
see... What a mistake, huh?
Oh, it's kind of like the story of Judas. Anyway, so I went to... This is a story that tells a lot about India. I went to Satyanand, Maharishi's second man, and said, oh, but how could anybody take on such terrible karma to kill a saint like Tatwala Baba? And he said to me, oh, Nancy, it happens quite often. Sometimes it's the only way those old boys will ever go. You know, India is so unexpected.
So do you think that Tatwala Baba made him do it?
I think he probably could have stopped it if he wanted to.
So he probably knew it was coming. He's waiting. He said, I hope you're good at this because I've got an agenda.
Well, you know, if you were a Buddhist, you would cry at a death and cry at a birth and rejoice at a death. So.
Yeah, I've heard that many times. In all of your years going back and forth to India, you went on some very interesting courses with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, and I noticed that you were on that famous course that the Beatles were on with Mia Farrow and a number of other
celebrities. That was pretty good timing on my part.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about that or a lot about it, depending on what you have in
mind. Well, Maharishi made me his liaison with the Beatles and the Beach Boys and Donovan and Mia, and... I must say I found them all very creative, attractive, fun. I didn't care too much about some of the aspects of Mia. As a matter of fact, if Woody Allen had read my book, maybe might not have asked her out for that first luncheon.
Now, of course, Prudence was on that course. I knew
and she was
Prudence.
A darling person.
I was going to say, I know Prudence, you know, years later.
And she's a teacher for Maharishi, yeah. But she was in sad shape during that course.
And Dear
Maharishi
Prudence,
brought her back.
Dear Prudence was one of the songs that the...
John Lennon wrote it.
Right, right.
Sitting out in front of her door strumming his guitar. I have a picture of him at that moment.
Let's talk a little bit about the course. First of all, why would a person, or why did you decide to go on a course to become a teacher?
Well, just before that, in 1966 and 67, I took Maharishi around South America and opened 8 new foundations in 8 different countries for him. And then he asked me to become a teacher. It was a great honor because there were only 2 or 3 teachers in the world then. But I said to him, oh, Maharishi, could I come a year later because I've been gone so much from home. You see, I have 4 children. And I said, I really feel I have to go home now and I'll come back and take the course in 68. He said, fine. And we were 80 people, and 30 of us became teachers. The others became, you know, what do you call it? They checked or they lectured about TM, but only 30 of us became teachers.
Type of associates or something.
Right, right, right.
And a teacher is what? Maybe you could just tell people.
A teacher is an initiator.
Okay, initiator.
Maharishi said, I will... multiply myself through you as teachers. And that's why we stick very much to his exact words when we do teach. Now, I want to point out that I am not a member of any organization. I really don't care for spiritual organizations because, unfortunately, so often these little sycophants get around their master and want to seem, you know, so important in the master's eyes but are not very nice to the people who are below them. And eventually, I just said to Maharishi, I couldn't work within his organization. I have probably more friends in the Buddhist world at this stage, but I still teach TM.
So the point is that when Maharishi made you a teacher and these other teachers, they don't have to teach within the organization. Is that what you're saying? Or?
No, you're supposed to teach within the organization. But I was a member of the SRM, which is no longer in existence, the Spiritual Meditation Movement. And if I just feel that as long as I stay within the boundaries of what Maharishi taught us as teachers, it's such a beautiful gift to share with people. And I don't have to be a member of an organization.
You told some very interesting stories about that celebrity course.
I think I told the truth about why John Lennon left in such fury. Because, you know, there have been all sorts of mistaken quotes.
Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people don't realize what was going on at that point. Now, the Beatles, of course, were the music, the trendsetter at that point. I mean, that was...
The most popular celebrities in the world at the time.
They were only the only group that was even close to them, of course, was the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
And the Rolling Stones, okay. So, I mean, basically we're looking at two out of three of the biggest groups at that era, which was, what year was it?
68.
George Harrison, of course, was the one who was highly influenced by all the sitar music.
What a darling
music.
Man, yes. Right. Dear man. It was his wife who brought the Beatles to Maharishi originally in England after their manager, Brian Epstein, died. And they needed, you know, some consoling, and they went to Maharishi.
Hmm. So you had a chance then to, you know, be in a different perspective with the Beatles. I mean...
Yes, I took them shopping, and I had all my meals with them.
How was the press... during this whole time?
Well, you see, this is one of the things that most people don't realize. Maharishi made a promise to the Beatles that he would not allow any media to interrupt this quiet that he offered them in the Valley of the Saints. So, and I realized years ago I'd had something to do with PR, and I said to him, Maharishi, with all these people, you know, taking a boat and coming out, first of all, a five-hour drive, then across the Ganges and up the hill to be told nothing, you have to put together a press kit. Give them something to take back with them. But he would say, no, no, no. They can talk to the Beatles in a month or two when they're feeling.
Wow.
And, you know, then the real stories started. They didn't have to have any basis of truth at all.
All right, let's come back and let's talk about some of these incredible stories that had no basis that we've all listened to and probably have seen in book after book after book. Right now we are talking about the time that she spent with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi in 1968 on the very famous course with the Beatles and Mia Farrow and who else?
Donovan Leitch, Paul Horn, Mike Love of the Beach Boys.
Interesting. We were about to hear the construction of false stories.
deconstruction.
that you were trying to somehow work with. Give us some examples. Of course, a lot of this is in the book, isn't it?
Yes, it's in the book. One perfect example is that the Beatles were very enamored with Maharishi, and they should have been because he gave them a great deal of extra teaching and time. And after John and George had been there for almost 2 months, Maharishi called me in one night, and John gave me a list of all the machinery and the personnel to send to Apple Corps, to have them come immediately to Maharishi's ashram to start photographing for the film on Maharishi's master's life. And it was about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning when I finally got back to Maharishi and found that he was in a side room talking to George Harrison, so I left a note saying, I'll come back early. Because Maharishi, I knew, had given Charlie Lutz, who was the head of the worldwide organization then, permission to sign a contract with 4-Star to make the same movie. So when I got a hold of Maharishi the next morning and I pointed that out, he said, oh, well, there'll be plenty of work. They can all work together for the glory of Gurudev. And I said, I don't think it works quite that way, Maharishi. So about 3 days later, when Charlie arrived with the 4-Star lawyer with a signed contract, and then the announcement was made to the Beatles. A day later, the Beatles left. It was John Lennon who really was angry about it. And I go into quite a bit of detail about that in the book.
So basically, you know, we've heard that John left for many, many reasons. But you're telling us that the real reason is because there was some kind of a mistake in, or Something happened.
That's right.
We call it double booking.
Well, but you know, these gurus are very naive sometimes. They know nothing about
Maharishi's
business world.
Point was that he thought that everybody would work together.
Oh, it'd be an honor. Yeah. Yes.
Meanwhile, of course, there's two separate companies that want exclusive rights or they won't play the game.
Now, the reverse of that.
Was the movie ever made?
Oh, it's sitting in a can somewhere. They took reels and reels and reels. But, you know, the reverse of that was Mia's reaction, say, to Maharishi paying her a great honor and doing a personal puja, which is like a mass, on her birthday. And she accused him, or to me, of making a pass at her because he put a lei of flowers around her head and then put his hand on her hair. Now, I had the same thing done for me, and I had tears rolling down my cheeks. I was so honored, so thrilled to have this beautiful ceremony done for me. Now, there's one person
is
looking at
this the famous story where people were saying that this was a guru who was out...
That making passes.
Making passes at women.
I tell you.
Well, all right. It's interesting because this is the kind of information that people hear and they have no other source.
That's right.
At all.
That's
they only hear. They only
I happen
hear
to be there at the time.
Mia Farrow. Okay, now that's a lot spent on that course, but a lot of people became very, very familiar with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi after that.
You know, one of my when I came back and became a teacher, one of the people that I think I really succeeded bringing a new dimension into her life was Greta Garbo. Greta Garbo used to come every year and spend six weeks to 2 months with Gaylord Houser, the great health czar, who started the whole sort of health food movement, and he was like my uncle. And I think that Garbo said to me, during the 15 years that she meditated off and on with me, she said, you know, Nancy, it's made me so much more courageous about life. So, and Gaylord, who addressed, you know, thousands of people in his audiences, he would get up there and say, the best beauty treatment of them all, besides being a health treatment, is transcendental meditation. Hmm. Not bad.
Starting to sound like a show that we're selling TM on.
You know, I want to say that, well, I should point out that every major religion and philosophy in the world has some system of meditation. I happen to like TM, but any system where you sit down and you quietly go within and you get yourself centered, you start developing your own intuitive heart knowingness, I think brings a totally new dimension of love of self, and you're more adventuresome in life. I just think, I've seen such wonderful results, let's say in my own family. During the 60s, I had three sons, in one at Stanford, one at UCLA, and one at Yale. They never got into the drug scene. My daughter was still in grammar school. But by having a mind expansion technique of their own, they could refuse to smoke a joint with, say, one of their friends and still not be considered square because they had something that was kind of outrageous that they were doing.
You've got some really interesting pictures in here. I noticed that in every picture, here's Mia Farrow. Here's one from Look magazine. Remember Look?
And that middle face in there of the young man is my son.
So you've got Look.
My youngest son, right.
California campuses, meditation replaces drugs. And now meditation hits the campus. How Hindu monk Maharishi turned students on without drugs. That was 1968 Look magazine.
Yeah.
Here's one from Post. It says, here's the scene, the Beatles, Mia Farrow, and a Post reporter all gather in India to meditate with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. And then this is left to right. It's a nice picture here.
Yeah.
Ringo Starr, Jenny Boyd, Jane Asher, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, Patty Harrison, Cynthia Lennon, and John Lennon. Well, that was quite a time that you were involved there, Nancy.
My daughter was so thrilled when she received a letter on her birthday signed by the four Beatles. She took it to school and allowed everybody to touch it.
Right.
But you know, Bruce, I want to make sure that, you know, the Beatles did not discover Maharishi. When we came back from our South American trip, there were over 500 people at the airport to meet Maharishi on our return. His movement was doing well in Germany, Canada, England, and had just started to take off in the United States.
You talk quite a bit about what happened later on, and in your continuing trips, I noticed that you went back for one of those special courses after you had...
Oh, the levitation course.
...been with... Merv Griffin.
Yes.
Merv was an interesting situation. Is there anything that we should know about Merv Griffin?
He loved Maharishi.
How about he now?
Yes, I think he still loves him.
Okay.
Whether he continues meditating or not, I don't know. But whatever he's done, he certainly has been fortunate in life, hasn't he?
Yes. That's what we see anyway.
Yeah.
What was your overall reaction to that whole... They used to call it the wave.
there was a wave
of meditation. I mean, it became so big.
Well, you know, they just had about 5,000 of them in Washington, D.C. last month, for a month. And evidently, the chief of police, or somebody high up in the police, said that the crime rate went down 24%. So I guess they're doing as good a job as when the Pope comes.
So basically, what we can see here is that... no matter what happens, it seems to still be going on. I mean, it's not a trend. I mean, there were those people who said, well, transcendental meditation is a trend of the 1970s and it'll fade off.
It hasn't at all. Like, for instance, in Japan today, centers are popping up all over because the Japanese businessman is now enjoying all the same stress that the American business people have had for years. And they desperately need something like some system of meditation.
You talk a lot about Mike Love of the Beach Boys.
Oh, I love Mike. He stayed a dear friend of Maharishi's also.
Why don't you share maybe something that stands out in your mind?
Well, I think the thing that used to stand out in my mind about Mike is his costumes. He used to get himself up in the most... When he first arrived, he looked kind of like Rasputin. He had a big fur hat on and a long tunic and a bright red lining and... He eventually ended up wearing mainly the kurta pajamas. You know, when I took the Beatles to Rishikesh the first time, they went wild shopping in the Khadi house. That's all the handloom fabric that Gandhi...
And we see that on the cover of their two albums after.
Right, right. But you know, that little dressmaker, we called him the couturier of the ashram, he sat on a dirt floor under a little tent with a hand-driven... sewing machine, and yet his strange concoctions that he made for the Beatles went on to influence fashion around the globe, maybe more than Dior. Because everybody started having that kind of Beatle look, the long tunics and the loose under blouses and the baggy pants, and it was great fun.
There are a couple things though that you are not happy with, and one of them, of course, is you don't like the way the organization has grown, do you?
No, I don't. But I have to be honest. I don't like most organizations. There are too many egos involved, and you know, meditation is a technique. You really don't have to belong to an organization to get the benefit out of TM or any kind of meditation.
And of course, again, the title of your book is Beyond Grooves, which basically.
Right.
Is saying over and over again that once you get your technique, you can either be part of it or not, depending on what you want to do.
Yes. And, you know, I think it's a wonderful technique for especially older people, because in India, they teach you that life is divided into three parts. You are the student and the young person. Then you are the family person or professional. You take care of the young. And then the third part of your life should be the best. That's the time when you should devote to raising your own conscious level, because that's all you take out with you when you go each time. You know, I do believe in all those different lifetimes. And in the West, it's kind of sad because we have a tendency to dismiss older people as kind of being useless.
Matter of fact, we praise the 17 to 30 and... And that's it. That's all anybody ever talks about or sees on the screen. Nobody really seems to praise the rest of it. And everyone seems to be looking
for
the day they can.
And the wisdom in our elders is so important.
Just for those of you who are just wondering, Nancy Cook de Herrera is my guest. The book, Beyond Gurus. There were some pretty big names in the movement anyway that have disappeared. Jerry Jarvis, Charlie Lutz.
Oh, I see a lot of them
all
the time.
What happened to these people?
Well, Charlie has
How about
a,
this one? Larry Domesh. I mean, these are names of people that have carried a tremendous weight. And most recently, Dr. Deepak Chopra. What's going on?
I love Deepak. Well, you know, Deepak was a very, very successful endocrinologist associated with a Boston clinic. And for all these years, he, as far as I'm concerned, has really paid his dues. He learned a great deal from Maharishi. He carried the mantle of Ayurvedic teachings for Maharishi all around the globe. And I think now he wants to get back to more of his medical roots. And he's going to join the Sharp Memorial Hospital in La Jolla. And he's going into, you know, more alternative types of medicine.
So, I mean, it's not like he's split from the movement.
No, and he loves Maharishi dearly. Now, how the movement itself, the organization, will regard him, that's another thing, and I don't think it's really that important.
Mm-hmm. What about these other people, Jerry Jarvis, Charlie Lutz?
I see Charlie Lutz, and Jerry all the time.
I mean, I noticed that Charlie Lutz is constantly giving these seminars all over the place.
He has a following all over the United States. I had dinner with him about three nights ago. We go to this Mexican restaurant, and we catch up on everything. We're all in shock because they're starting to charge so much money to teach meditation. Mm-hmm. And this is something I really don't understand.
So you find that to be, what, wrong, right, what?
Well, I don't like to play
opinion-based judge. Here's an opinion.
I don't like to play judge, but I really feel that when Maharishi first came here to the United States, he made the statement that money should never keep a person from learning to meditate. After all, every person who is meditating is giving out harmonious vibrations, which help the whole globe. So why make it hard for a person to learn to meditate? I do know that Maharishi also found that Americans are very materialistically minded, and that sometimes if you give them something for nothing, they think it's worth nothing. So I totally approve of having someone make a donation, but I think it has to be, you know, within reach, a reasonable donation.
So you're feeling that when people start charging exorbitant amounts of money for any kind of program,
I get the feeling they have to pay for a lot of their overhead that they've mm-hmm. collected.
how has this changed your life? I mean, it's obviously it's changed it, but where were you before all this, and now where are you?
Well, I really came from
a
very happy...
Book. You wrote a book, so I mean, obviously...
And I've got another one I'm going to start on now, but it'll take place in Argentina during the time of Perón and Evita. I would say this. I think amongst my peers, I probably am known for having a very good energy level. And I'm very healthy, very happy. And a lot of the people who thought I was absolutely crazy 32 years ago... When I came back, and
are convinced now.
Little by little, they come to my door, and I teach them to meditate. Yes,
that's interesting. So, you know, one of the things you got to see, and I think a lot of people have forgotten that today you can go to almost any doctor, and he will first of all talk about stress,
right?
And they will talk about stress reduction. And
right.
We'll even talk about stress reduction techniques, which include meditation. 25 years ago, no one talked about stress.
No.
And if they did talk about stress, they never mentioned meditation.
No.
So you've had a chance to see a complete change.
I sat at Maharishi's feet when Dr. Herbert Benson first came to meet Maharishi. I was so in awe of Maharishi's teachings, but... Dr. Benson, in my opinion, although he's a very brilliant mind, has quite a big ego. And he eventually wrote a book saying you can transcend on any word. And I noticed that Consumer's Digest did a wonderful article on mind-body connection, a whole page, Dr. Herbert Benson. And every word he said in that article came directly from Maharishi. But Bruce, the difference is, in Maharishi's system, they're using mantras that have been proved for thousands of years, where Dr. Benson is just picking any word he wants and says you can transcend on it. I like the idea of having a tradition behind those sounds.
I think it was pointed out once by someone that during the time that his book was a bestseller, and the world was learning how to say one.
Yes.
The rest of his family was doing transcendental meditation, including Herbert Benson.
That's right.
So there was something about that. I don't know what it was, but I guess he earned a living or something with it. You were going to be going back to India.
I go back in January. I'm taking a leading cardiologist and a psychotherapist with me who are very interested more and more in alternative medicine. And this one man, who's one of the top cardiologists in the country, he feels that he would like to just touch the spiritual side of India before he starts out on this whole new adventure that he's going into.
You talk quite a bit about some of the spectacular courses. Most recently for you is this levitation course, and we hear about this once in
yes.
a while. When Maharishi, I guess, assembles large groups of people who meditate and levitate
the
together.
The cities, yes.
Yeah. What, a city is spelled what?
S-I-D-D-H-I.
Okay, and it means what?
It means purity. Not that I've seen a whole lot of that, but a siddhu is supposed to be total purity.
What is the purpose of this stuff?
You know, I think during that course, it was 4 months for me in a group of 50 women in a very secluded little valley in Switzerland. And my children talked me into doing it. Maharishi invited me to come, and they said, Mom, you've got to do it. And I said, okay, I'll do it, but I'll make you one promise. I am not moving off that padded floor if I have to sit for 4 months unless something lifts me up. And, of course, it did. I mean, the first 6 weeks we were on a very, very dreadful routine of almost, you know, no onions, garlic, seasoning, coffee, tea, no books, no newspapers, no music. Nothing attractive to your senses so that you would start going within. And then we started working with the first few of the sutras of Patanjali. And then the day came when we were given the Flying Sutra. And I must say, it was really like a madhouse, because when people started taking off, you know, they started sort of hopping around. And a lot of people would sing or chatter or scream. And it was really the best show in town. But I just sat there. And I didn't care. I wasn't going to move unless something moved me. And on the fifth day, I was moved. I got that tremendous heat up the spine that they call the Kundalini. And then this shaking all over. You have to have faith in order to do it, because it could be sort of scary. And then all of a sudden, I just started floating up and down and up and down. And of course, it's so amusing. I mean, you can't believe it. All your life you've been, you know, held down by
Gravity,
and all of a sudden, no gravity.
Which Maharishi says is just one of those laws that is made to be broken.
That's right. But you know, it was fascinating because just last summer, I went to see a friend in Nebraska, and I found a book that told all about Jesus's trip where he went to India. You know, he spent about 17 years in India, and he first studied with the Vyasa Krishna people in Orissa, and studied all about the Vedas. Then he went up to Leh Ladakh, to the Hemis Monastery, and there he studied the sutras, the Buddhist sutras, and many people in India believe that he learned his miraculous abilities from those people. And many of those sutras were the sutras that Maharishi was teaching.
Well, I'm sure that a lot of Christians will not agree with that, but that's in the Bible, I guess.
But
that's,
you know, I can say that I am a Christian today because of the explanations that I learned about Jesus' teachings in the East and not the West. You know, in the West they say, you know, perform good acts and then you will know God, as though God is out there. But in the East they say you are part of God. It's natural to perform good acts. I love some of the explanations that Maharishi gave me in answer to questions. It put everything into the right order for me.
When you came off the course, I see in the book you said Maharishi's advice to us was, be careful with your desires.
Yes, your minds will be very strong. You might get them.
So I guess what happens is, when you change consciousness, what happens is that you begin to manifest the thoughts.
But you know what was interesting? I read some books while I was there that Jerry Jarvis gave me, very advanced yoga books, and I understood them perfectly. And now maybe let a year or so pass and I'm no longer doing my program. I look at those books, I don't understand them at all. It just shows how your mind can open up. And during that course, I had some glimpses of things that I knew I had never learned, but I now knew. So I have decided that when I reach 100, I will go into advanced yoga.
So you are convinced that it affects your health?
No question. No question. Absolutely. And a couple of times when I've had to have a minor operation, it never fails. The anesthesiologist will come back and say, could I ask you a personal question? Yes, of course. Why not? And it's always, are you a meditator by any chance? And I'll say, yes. And I had to have some skin cancer things taken off that involved quite a bit of surgery. And that's probably as a result of my radio activity. But they always pick it up themselves. And then the machine doing your metabolism, the nurses will say, your metabolism didn't change at all. And you give out so much alpha. Now that's machines picking it up.
Right.
It's not my telling someone.
Okay. If you wanted to tell people in 2 minutes what you think they should know about life, what you've learned, if you wanted to impart some wisdom to someone, what would you say?
Well, I would hope that they would read my book because I think it tells a lot about some tests that I either passed or flunked. I encourage people to hang in there. There's a reason for everything. And my wish for them would be, may nature support your every desire.
Once again, the book, Beyond Gurus, Nancy Cook De Herrera, DeHerrera. Thank you for being on the show today, Nancy.
Oh, I enjoyed it, Bruce. Thank you.
And thank you for listening and tuning into Timeless Voyager Radio. This is Bruce Stephen Holmes, and I hope that your own personal voyage through life towards development of your highest potential is a joyous and successful one.